I love to read, but I don't read fiction. And I have a lot of friends who read fiction, and I will ask them, why do you read fiction? And they will tell me, we read fiction because we love stories. Then they turn the sword over and say, don't you love a good story? And I'll say, oh, I love a good story. They say, well, why don't you read fiction? Because the best of fiction is just the retelling and telling of a good story. I love a good story. I love movement in a good story. Of people found situated in a particular circumstance, and then over time, you watch the story unfold, and they are situated in a different circumstance as the story ends. And the best of those stories start with desolation, abandonment, lack, loss, and end with surprising provisions of great. Stories starting with brokenness and stories ending in made whole. That's God's story of redemption, is it not? And actually, Hollywood's made its best money on just retelling that story over and over again in different skin. The book of Ruth is that story. It's the story about those who came to be broken. It's the story of how God intervened and made them whole. It's the story of Jesus. Well before Jesus is ever introduced later, we come along this history in the Old Testament this morning in this story in the book of Ruth, which we shall look at, God willing, over the next 4 weeks, including this morning. We'll be looking at this great story. It's a wonderful piece of history that will reshape our understanding of life. None of us live very long before we stumble upon what is absolutely true, is that we live in a good and broken world. We live in a world that is great to live in, but a world that is broken, and we feel palpably what John said when he said, someday, for those who hope in Jesus, the first things will be passed away. Tears, crying, mourning, disease, death, those first things will someday be gone. And as we look forward to what lies ahead, we yet have to live through some days that are at least bewildering. I think of a Daniel Boone quote this morning. He said, in all of his wanderings around, I was never lost, but I was bewildered once for a 3-day period. And I think all of us understand, as we walk by faith and not by sight, what Boone was talking about in 3 days on the frontier, bewildered. So I want us to look at this story. We love life. We enjoy its epic joys and its fun days. But all of us know there are other days that are tough: setbacks, disappointments, grief, cancer, parenting conundrums, loss, struggle, and all the while faith. And the hardest struggle of all is trying to figure out how faith intersects with all those things that we are experiencing, all the while walking by faith and not by sight. How do we make sense out of what's going on when it makes no sense? Maybe you've arrived at the auditorium this morning and approached our Lord and realized, right now, Eric, my life makes no sense. You're reading my mail. Ruth is going to speak to my heart in this moment in my life. And if you're going through a tough moment, just look around in the room. I want you to know you're among fellow sojourners who are in this same world of our common humanity, facing the same things. You're not unique. And God is in control, and he's going to show us in the story where that can take us. Ruth will help us. Should we give up when the going gets tough? One commentator said, Ruth teaches us that God writes the greatest stories with surprising and even delightful turns. This story is full of intrigue. This story is full of movement. So is life. If we will resolutely hold on to our sovereign Lord, it works out. Watching this story unfold makes a person believe that Romans chapter 8 and verse 28 is actually true. That all things do over time and into eternity work together for the good of those who are called according to his purpose and who love him. What I'd like to do this morning is tell you the story of chapter 1. It's the setting. We must get into the setting. It's a dark story. It's a sad story. There are tears in chapter 1, and isn't that realistic in a broken world? But secondly, Eric, this piece of history, how will it help me? Well, I want to explain three ways that this story helps us in real life. You have to go back to school tomorrow. You have to go back to your job, live in your neighborhood. We got to pay our bills and act responsibly this week. How on earth is this story going to help? Let me give you three ways. That's our plan of attack. Ruth chapter 1. It's in the white pages of the Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, the first five books of the law. Joshua takes them into the land. Then you get the Judges, a time characterized by chaos. Judges 17:6, when every man did that which is right in his own eyes. And if you don't understand what that is, just look out your window at home. It's American culture at this moment, is it not? But it was actually a chaotic time in the Old Testament. And that's when this story takes place, the book of Ruth. May I read you the first chapter? In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of the wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. And both Mahlon and Chilion died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on their way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, and even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me." So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Hear the word of the Lord. There are 9 movements in this story. Let's go over them quickly to master the story and then think about how this story becomes a paradigm to look through, a model to look through, a lens to look through to see life in the work of God. The story begins, according to verse 4, it's a story of a 10-year downward spiral. We go into a decade of life for Naomi, and wow, is it a tough decade. It lasted, as decades do, for 10 years. And it was 10 years when she would look back, and it wasn't the iconic memory of that joyful time and that joyful time and that joyful time. It was, I was homeless. I was a refugee. I had nothing to eat. And my husband died. My daughters were married. And the joy of the weddings were hardly out of our minds before both of their husbands died. And here I sit, abandoned in Moab. Well, the first movement is that the house of bread has empty shelves. They were from Bethlehem. Bethlehem means house of bread. This is the farming community. This is the farmers, the breadbasket, providing all the food. Once in a while, they'll show a picture of a hurricane coming in and people having runs on the store. And so they'll take a picture of the bread aisle. Nothing but shelves. Nothing there. They'll take a picture of the water aisle. All the water's gone. All the bread's gone. Well, it's all empty. It's all gone. There's nothing to eat in Bethlehem. And so this man, apparently a man with means, he could finance the trip to go to Moab. He goes searching for food. One of the tragedies of Katrina and New Orleans was that the dear ones living in New Orleans had no means to get out of the city. By that I mean they had no money to use to book passages to hotels and hang out for a week and could eat on. They just didn't have such margins, and so they thought the best thing was to hunker down and go through it, and that, of course, was tragic. Abimelech, he has some margin, and he decides he's going to use some of the margin, so he finances a trip down to Moab because he hears, hey, there's something to eat down there. Now, you got to remember that this is in the time of the judges, a time of rebellion for the people of God, and also Deuteronomy 28, 29, and 30. If you look at the headers over the chapters, it says blessings and cursings. And it says to the people of God, Moses tells them before he dies, if you will obey me, God speaking to his people, if you'll obey me, I'll bless you. If you disobey me, I'll take away the blessing in order to wake you up to your disobedience and turn your erring heart around. So it's actually a gracious thing when we face the consequences of our sin because it can turn our heart back to our Lord. So obviously the Lord wasn't blessing them with a great harvest of wheat and barley. They had nothing to eat. And that's indicative of their rebellion generally in the nation. So then the displaced refugees go to find something to eat. In order to survive, they go to Moab. Now some have said, and it's the reading interpretive issue of the book. Well, I'll tell you what, Abimelech's a big rebel. He's leaving the people of God. He's leaving the land of God and going to Moab. Now, you got to remember, tragically, Moab is in Abraham's family. And even in the law, while it told you don't marry Canaanites, it didn't say don't marry Moabites. So some look at this story and say, Abimelech was in full rebellion, so God judged him. That's why he dies and then his son dies and there. I take it more as a guy scratching and clawing, trying to find something to eat. This is about survival. Because apparently, along the way, Ruth had seen something in this family's faithfulness to the one true God that she wanted. She said, your God is now my God. I'm embracing you. So it's an interesting read. They go to find something to eat. Well, tragedy breaks out. No sooner they get down there, get a little barley sandwich, whatever that is, barley soup, and Abimelech dies. I mean, we're talking about real people in real situations facing real life in a broken world. This is it. You know, it's amazing. Here we sit. If there's an infinite amount of time, and I know you think I believe I have that every Sunday morning when I go to preach, but it just for you to tell your stories, I mean, in every section, there are stories that will make you cry. I would say in every pew, there are stories to make you cry. And what people have been through, the tragedies, the turns in the road, the disappointments, the loss. Isn't this garden variety life in a broken world? The hard stuff that people are going through. You may look at me this morning and say, Eric, having gone through, what do you mean? I'm going through it right now. I'm in the midst of it right now. And I'm glad you're here for these 4 weeks, because this story is about the power and sufficiency of God to take us from broken to made whole. It's actually a preview of what Jesus does before Jesus ever gets here. He's a redeemer, a reclaimer. God has a famous reputation for such. I was speaking with a woman on Monday, and she met a friend of mine, and they figured out that both of them knew me, and she said, oh, I've asked Eric to do my funeral. And I thought, I forgot. She did tell me that. I better go talk to her. And so I was in Springfield, Ohio for an appointment. I rang her up and went over, and we had the best visit. And I said, you know, Betty, I don't know a lot about your life. Let's just start. You know, when were you born? Tell me about you. She said, one of the first sentences she told me, I never knew my father. I've known her for a long time, 55 years. And I never knew that about her. But that's just life in a broken world, is it not? We could go person to person. Tragedy breaks out in the husband's death. Then the two sons marry and both face untimely deaths. Now remember, a widow's hope was if God had given her a son, he'd take care of her. And if she was a widow, she not only had one son, she had two sons. And her hope that she was going to be all right and survive was going to be the mother-in-law's apartment. Well, if the sons die, there's no possibility of a mother-in-law's apartment. And there's no sustenance for the family. And this is way before the days of public assistance. So the two sons marry and face untimely death. That's verses 4 and 5. Now, then verse 6 breaks out, and there's a little hint that maybe there's going to be a change. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return to the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab. Notice, she's out there scratching and clawing herself. She's turned into a gleaner out there scratching, trying to make it work. She's in the fields, but they start talking in the fields and say, hey, you know what we've heard? We've heard that the Lord has visited his people and given them food. Now, this word visit is a very special word. It lies there. It looks very benign in English, but it's a special word in the original language. And all through the Old Testament, whenever the Lord visited, that was good. Maybe you, growing up, Andy had a sister who wasn't married till she was 40. And so our children, we always loved it when Shelly came, because she'd roll in and she'd bring two trash bags in the house. This is back in the days of VHS. One was VHSs of children's movies, and the other was like candy that would rot their teeth out, and it would be full of sugar all weekend. But it was just, we loved it whenever Shelley visited, because the kids would, it was like Disneyland for the weekend, you know. Well, this special word noted the times when God visited his people. God visited his people when they were in Egypt, and it got better for God's people. God visited his people, and the Red Sea parted, and they walked out and went to the promised land. So this special word, here it is. She had heard God the Redeemer was doing some redemption, that he was acting to redeem, and that he visited his people. And she said to herself, that's just like him to do that. That's just what he does. That's characteristic of him. And a thought was born in her mind, I'm going to go back home. I've been here 10 years, and look what it's got me. My husband died. My two sons-in-law died. I'm out here scrounging, nothing to eat. But God has visited. I want you to know that God's still visiting people. God's still visiting families, and God's still visiting broken circumstances, and God's still doing that healing, redeeming work. And who of us this morning doesn't need a fresh visit from our Lord? And He's available to us. Now, Naomi encourages her daughter-in-law to go back home. And she uses logic and persuasion. Look, I'm old, not going to have any more children. Get back home. The best thing you could do, go back there, you're young. Get a husband and find rest. By the way, God always designed for the home to be a place where the inhabitants of the home could find shalom. Shalom in the leadership of a godly man who is breaking his neck to serve his family. The leadership of a responsive woman who was honoring the Lord in deference to her husband who was laying his life down in service to the family. And for them to have peace at home was God's design. She says, go home and find rest. By the way, is there rest at your home? Or is it restive? Another word describing the exact opposite. Well, God will visit your home and help you if you have an open heart. But she tells them, go back home. And so Orpah is, she concludes, although it was bitter to say goodbye, that she'd go home. And so she goes back to Moab. But Ruth, the verse 14, Ruth clings to her. She's not going to leave. No, I'm not leaving you. And she says in this incredible statement, do not urge me to leave you, verse 16, or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you. She's saying, no, Naomi, you don't understand. I have thrown in my lot with you. Your God has become my God. I've forsaken the idols of the Moabitess people, and I have taken up identity with the people of God. And wherever they're going, I'm going with them. It's quite a statement of faith from this woman. Now, so they go back. Verse 19 suggests that Abimelech was a man of high standing because all the city takes notice that she returns. Here comes the mayor's wife. But they were stunned, and all the women begin to talk to each other. And who knows what she looked like before she left. If he was a prominent person, often the prominent people in the ancient Near East married these beautiful wives. But they look at her walking in town and they say, are you kidding me? Is that Naomi? Could that be her 10 years later? You ever seen a methamphetamine addict's picture like the before and the after? These beautiful pictures of happy visages and then 10 years of methamphetamine abuse. They look like bombed out faces and bombed out eyes. And tragic mouths and teeth. You say, what happened? So that's what's going on. The people say in verse 19, so the two of them went out until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. Apparently prominent. And the women said, could this be Naomi? Now, remember, the great irony is Naomi's name means pleasant. And they say, is that you, Naomi? She said, don't call me pleasant. Call me Mara. That means bitter. And she is quite open about her perception. The hand of the Lord has gone out against me. The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. The Almighty has brought calamity upon me. And so they come into the city, but then in verse 22, there's a little hint. It's small. It simply says, they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And you're left thinking, I wonder where that's going. It's just a little piece. It's amazing how God can use the smallest thing to lift up our head. The little thing, the little grace, the small graces, as one song calls it, Well, how should we then live? Okay, Eric, nice story. You know, what is this? Sunday school. I got to go to work tomorrow. How is this any good? Three things. Number one, don't be shocked by mayhem. It's a real thing in a broken world. Some are stupefied in shock at what we face in a broken world. What do we expect? Sin entered and death came. We love to sing Joy to the World at Christmas, and I love to sing it anytime because I love what it says. In fact, my favorite verse in all of hymnody, no more let sin and sorrow reign, nor thorn infest the ground. He comes to make his blessing known as far as that curse is found. Oh, we'll sing Joy to the World like we've never sung Joy to the World when Jesus comes and heals everything in the new heavens and the new earth. Wow, that's going to be amazing. When all those first things are taken away. But in the meantime, verse 5 and verse 21, we're going to face shocking things. Both Malon and Chilion died so that the woman was left without her two sons and husband. Just a direct report of a tragedy. And you've been through some tragedies. I know a few of your stories. Verse 21, I went away full and the Lord has brought me back empty. Maybe you're sitting here this morning and you say, yep, that's me. There was a season in my life when I felt like it was full. Here I sit, empty. Peter said, don't let it shock you that we face hard things. Don't be surprised by that. We're not living in heaven now. We're living in this good and broken world, groaning and travailing, waiting to be redeemed. The struggles we go through remind us that this is not our eternal home. You've heard people say it. I can't believe it. Is it hard to embrace the struggles we face? Absolutely. I hate them as much as you hate them. But to pretend like we are not facing them is not helpful. The best way to face hard stuff is not to deny that it's going on, but to recognize that we are facing hard providence in a world that is broken, in a world after the resurrection that is being set aright by the living Lord of glory who will someday make that known in his coming. Now, I'm not arguing that we all need to be Eeyore, you know, Winnie the Pooh's friend. Poor chap was always down on everything. You know, he's a real downer. No, I'm not talking about that. I don't think we should sit around and, okay, well, when's the next bad thing going to happen to you? When's the next bad thing going to happen to you? When you guys think the next bad thing is going to happen to me? I don't think sitting around waiting for the next shoe to drop honors our Lord. In fact, I love Lady Wisdom in Proverbs 31. What does it say about her perception of the future? She smiles at the future. You know what's just fantastic about our sufficient Lord? He can sustain us in the middle of the brokenness. And he not only delivers us out of brokenness, he also delivers us through brokenness. Being in shock will not help us face the real stuff. The first step is to look down the barrel of the struggle and say, okay, struggle, I want you to know that God is bigger than you. And then live like that's true. That's called faith. Secondly, don't let the mysteries of God's justice lead you to abandon the faith. Look at verse. What does she say? Here's three confessions from Naomi. Now, this gets back to how are we to read the book of Ruth? Are we to read it as Abimelech was a rebel? He was running away from God, so God judged him. He died. Then his son-in-laws died, and his wife was marooned. Some say that's how you read it. He was a rebel. I don't read it like that. In fact, while I think that Naomi's perspective is jaded and shows up, and by the way, you gotta be careful what we have to be careful what conclusions we draw about God in the midst of struggle. We can rearrange our theology in the midst of the struggle, and that's note to self: don't do that. Verse 13, the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Verse 20, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Verse 21, the Almighty has brought calamity upon me. She defers to the Lord and recognizes his sovereign rule over all things, but took a very dark view of what was going on in the midst of her broken heart. Has Naomi lost sight of God's work in the chaos? I believe she has. And I believe that's what's behind these comments. But by the way, you say, Eric, give her some credit. She recognized God's rule. She had a broken heart. She buried her husband. She buried her two sons-in-law. Wasn't looking very good. Isn't that what a person says when they see this? I'm just arguing that, remember when the author of the book of Hebrews defined faith? Faith is the substance of what we hope for and the evidence of what we do not see. How many of us in the midst of the hard things we face can't see God at work? But faith is that gesture of acting as though it were so, because it is true when we cannot see it. All Naomi could see was carnage. Hubbard said, here is a bitter complaint cloaked in firm faith. Well, maybe. Or is it an episode of doubt? Don't we all face doubt and wonder whether or not it is true, especially in the midst of suffering and struggle? But here is this dear woman faced with so much grief that she begins to doubt. By the way, doubt is a halfway house between belief and unbelief. I love Oz Guinness's thoughts on doubt. As it resolves, and you've watched people begin to question some things, begin to doubt, begin to wonder, and then God brought them through, and on the other side of doubt, it came to more fully robust faith on the other end of that struggle. Maybe you're in the midst of that this morning. Just persevere. We step when we cannot see. We undergo what we do not understand. The tension here is, what's going on? Is God punishing them for leaving? But wait, could God be at work in this chaos? Could God be at work in this chaos in ways we haven't seen? You see, it's too bad many of us don't already know the story. Because I want you to sit in the ambiguity of what in the world's going on. This looks awful, because that's how it looks at the end of chapter 1. But that brings us to the third point. Don't forget that God will write other chapters in our stories. Yes, it's true. The best I got this morning is this insight to tell you the book of Ruth does not end at the end of chapter 1. A lot of us are in chapter 1 stories, or we've been there, and some of us have concluded it's over. It's all over. There won't be any future. This story does not end with this chapter. That's the great lesson of chapter 1. There are other chapters. And the artful hint at the end of this chapter with the barley harvest is, hey, maybe the future is going to be dissimilar than the last 10 years. I've told you before, I believe. Forgive me for repeating it. When Barry Bonds was chasing that home run record, we bought tickets to a Giants-Reds game and took guests with us. Sat there, 9 innings, 3 at-bats, fly out and 2 ground outs, or a strike out and a ground out and a fly out. Underwhelming. But, alas, the Reds tied it up in the bottom of the 9th, and it went to extra innings. So we thought maybe he'll come up again. So they got several base runners in the 10th, and Bonds came up again. We thought, yes, it's going to happen now. And he struck out, as I recall. And we were with guests, and it was getting late, and it was a weeknight. And I said, look, you know, how are you guys for work tomorrow? What do you think? What do we ought to do? Let's leave. Nothing's going to happen tonight. So we start trekking for the car. 12th inning, we're trying to trek to the car, and we hear this, wah! And Bonds hits a home run out of the park. And all we saw was the poles in the parking lot, trying to remember where we had parked our car, you know? We didn't stay around long enough till it was resolved. We left too early. We pulled up stakes. In the midst of the hardest thing Andy and I have ever faced in our lives, in what in every frame was the darkest hour, a guy put his arm around me and he said, "Eric, this is a bad chapter. Don't make it the book. Turn the page and keep going." And he was right. By the way, part of the glory of those new pages is a privilege to be here doing this. You know how many people have concluded in Ruth chapter 1 that their life was over? Do you know how many people have said, "This is it. That decade was a mess, and I'm throwing in the towel"? You know what the book of Ruth says to us? Don't you dare bet against the goodness of God breaking out after your heart has been broken in half. Chapter 1 says this is bad, and it's true. But there's hope for a new day. This is not the end. God writes other chapters. He will for you. And we'll look at these in the book of Ruth in the coming weeks. Father, thank you for your mercies, your faithfulness to your promise. You're worthy of our trust. You're at work when we cannot see. You couldn't love us more. You've demonstrated that on Good Friday. Father, give us hope. Give us life. Pick us up. Heal our wounds. Carry us through. And demonstrate again that there's no Savior like Jesus, and that you are faithful to your people. We love you. Work in our midst this morning.